This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The violence inside the New Orleans Convention Center was even worse than previously described, according to interviews conducted by my guest, Christopher Drew. Drew is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, who is now in New Orleans, where he's been reporting on Katrina's aftermath. He co-wrote a front-page story on Sunday about the breakdowns in city, state, and federal responses to the hurricane. Drew covered how the Superdome and Convention Center turned into death traps. A little later, we'll hear from Eric Lipton, who reported on the communications breakdowns in government that resulted in the delayed and insufficient response to the hurricane. We called Christopher Drew earlier today in New Orleans. Chris, would you first just set the scene for us? Where are you? Where have you been staying?
Well, last night we got into the Sheraton Hotel downtown. It's the first time I haven't been on a sofa, an air mattress, or sleeping in a car or an RV in the 2 weeks I've been down here. And it's also a good sign of how much more quickly in certain aspects things are improving down here. Some of the big hotels actually got power back yesterday and have rigged up some temporary water solutions, and they're slowly opening floor by floor.
Let's talk a little bit about your reporting on what actually happened in the convention center during the storm. And you say that it was worse than we thought we knew. You say people at the Superdome were searched for weapons, but at the convention center, they weren't. Why not?
Well, the problem was there was no plan at the beginning to use the convention center. And all the people were, poor people in the city, were going to the Superdome, and that was supposed to be the main shelter. And as you recall, during the storm, a big chunk of the roof got ripped out. Water was coming in. They kept bringing people there. They ended up with 30,000 or so people in the Superdome, and everybody was sort of huddled back in the stands because it turned out the rip in the roof was right over the 50-yard line of the football field, and it scared everybody so much. I mean, nobody knew what was going to happen with the rest of the building. And then, as the floods came from the break in the 17th Street Canal levee, it basically surrounded the Superdome with 4 feet of water by Tuesday morning. So the city had to find another place to bring more people. They had to bring the people who were first people who were being rescued by the search and rescue boats that were going into the heavily flooded neighborhoods. There were hotel guests that couldn't stay in the high-rise hotels because of damage. They were hospital workers and patients from hospitals that got flooded out after the levee break. So all these people ended up being sent to the convention center.
You know, if they were actually officially sent to the convention center, it makes it more astounding that Michael Brown, the head of FEMA, didn't know they were there.
Well, it's totally astonishing that he said that, because I asked Mayor Ray Nagin here in New Orleans about his comment right after he said it. And Mayor Nagin said that for the 2 days that people were in the convention center before Michael Brown says he knew about it, that the mayor said he talked about how many people were there at a daily meeting he had with other FEMA officials and state officials. And so Michael Brown's deputies were at these meetings. So the mayor said if Michael Brown didn't know about it, it's just a problem of communication within FEMA.
What was the police presence like in the convention center?
The police, I'm not sure how many regular policemen there were. I know in the Superdome there were about 80 to 90 regular officers and a number of National Guardsmen conducting patrols. I never could figure out the number of regular policemen. There were some, I suspect fewer, in the convention center. But what was fascinating to me was I had an interview with the head of the New Orleans Police Department SWAT team, who was very candid about just how gruesome things were in the convention center. And there was gunfire every night, repeatedly. The SWAT team was called in by the regular police there, sometimes two or three times a night. He said that armed groups of thugs, 15 or 25 guys, actually took control of two of the six halls at the convention center and refused to let police and emergency workers in, and the SWAT team had to go in and retake those halls. And they had to do it without firing weapons because they had 15,000 people in there. And so they would go in there, and I can't imagine the guts it took for the SWAT team members, because he basically said, I mean, they would go in with full body armor and they had flashlights mounted on their weapons. But basically, when they saw a muzzle flash come out of the crowd somewhere that indicated somebody had fired, they would just rush the spot where the shot had been fired from with their flashlights shining in there. Of course, the flashlights were giving away their location as they moved in as well. And they would just try to grab anybody they found in there who had a gun or who seemed to be trying to run away.
Well, you write that the police captain said that the police department came close to abandoning the convention center and giving up on the people there. Because why? Because it was so dangerous for the police?
That's it. I mean, late in the week, it was just so chaotic, and the regular district policemen who were there, it was totally out of control. They couldn't handle it. I mean, as far as I can tell, I mean, people have talked about maybe the 300 or so New Orleans policemen who quit during the storm. Well, I was told maybe 17 or 18 of them were among the regular policemen in the convention center. The SWAT team even lost four of its 60 members just who couldn't believe they were doing the kind of things they had to do. But part of the problem was, in the Superdome, everybody was pretty much poor. But in this convention center, because the hotel guests, the hospital officials went over there, you had a really volatile mix of poor people and wealthier people or middle-class people. And so these thugs, it all started out with them trying to rob the people who seemed to have money and take their money and take their jewelry, and then it evolved into much worse. And the regular police just felt powerless. I mean, Captain Jeff Wynn, the SWAT team commander, told me that a number of regular policemen there told him about numerous women who had come back saying they had been dragged off by these gangs of 15, 20, 25 men and raped, and they would come back and report it to the police, and the police felt they couldn't do anything about it. He said some of the women would just go stand outside the convention center and refuse to go back in after this happened. And everybody was terrorized in the convention center. Captain Wynn said that when the SWAT team would go in there, I said, well, what do the regular people do when you're in there chasing these thugs? And he said they'd either be running for their lives or they'd be on the floor in a fetal position. And the other shocking thing, that when you think about the situation, the city's jail was totally flooded out. So they had no jail. And then when they caught some of these guys, they had nothing to do with them. They couldn't put them in jail. Everybody was too scared to finger them and identify them and want to testify about them. So I said, what did you do with them? And he said, well, the only thing we could do is just take them outside or take them to another hall in the convention and let them go and hope they didn't make their way back.
Now, you write that a captain in charge of the police was preparing to actually evacuate the police officers by helicopter because things were so out of control and so dangerous for the police. But they didn't evacuate the police. Why not?
Well, I think this was late in the week, and as they were preparing to do that, and the SWAT team got called in to help with that, somebody finally got through the National Guard, because there had been no National Guard presence there. I think there were 300 National Guardsmen at the Superdome, but I don't think there were any at the convention center. And so it was just this beleaguered small group of police. So they rushed 100 National Guard soldiers over there. I think they came from the Superdome. I never could nail that down for sure. And they did a sweep of the 6 convention halls as soon as they got there, and they got enough order restored that the police and with the SWAT team and the guard, you know, they managed to hang on till they got the people out. The other thing was that in both places, you know, there was too little backup generation. I mean, all they had at both places were dim emergency lights inside the buildings. There was no air conditioning, so it was totally sweltering, temperatures well over 100 degrees during the day at these places. And so you had people, old people, at the Superdome. Two-thirds of the people were women, children, and elderly, and a lot of them were infirm to begin with. So you had people dying in both places, not just from the violence, but just gave out. And the police commander in charge at the Superdome, Lonnie Swain, told me that Saturday, when the last people were leaving the Superdome, after they'd been in there since the previous Sunday, so almost a week, I saw some of them coming out, and it looked like the Bataan death march. They were so gaunt and dehydrated, but Lonnie Swain, the police commander, told me that a couple of people actually died just walking out of the dome after enduring those 6 days. And the bus is finally there. They died just walking out to get to the buses.
So, Chris, just standing back and looking at the big picture some more, where do you think were the greatest failures in the planning for evacuees at the Superdome and the Convention Center?
Well, I think there were big failures at every level of government. And I'm from New Orleans. I was born here. I grew up here. I went to school here. And my family is here. They all evacuated safely, but some of them lost their houses in the flooding, and some of them emerged okay. Amid the reporting, I've been going to check their houses. And what's just shocking and really disturbing to me is that for so many years, the scientists at LSU and other places have talked about how devastating a Category 5 storm could be, and everybody's known that. And it's just amazing to me that if you're going to put that many people in the Superdome, you know, you wouldn't have some means to get them out of the Superdome if the whole city started to flood. I mean, it's amazing to me that there wasn't more backup generation in the Superdome and the Convention Center. If they had been able to keep more lights on, if they had been able to keep the air conditioning on, a lot of these people wouldn't have died. And so I've pressed the city officials on that, and they all basically say, yeah, we should have done it. Part of the problem was the Saints want a new stadium, and there were actually some proposals to upgrade the Superdome as a shelter and have more backup power, and they were kind of held in abeyance while the state leaders decided whether to build a new stadium or not. But I think the other huge failure on the federal government's part, besides just the lateness with which FEMA responded, I think the other huge failure is that 3 years ago, the head of FEMA, Joe Albaugh, who was one of President Bush's campaign aides in his first presidential election, said that a bad hurricane in New Orleans would be one of the absolute worst things that FEMA had to deal with. And he and his people said 3 years ago, we're going to start working with the city and the state to plan better evacuation, better shelters, everything. So I sat down with the city's emergency preparedness head, Terry Ebert, the other day, and I said, well, how many meetings did you have with FEMA in the last 2 or 3 years? What did you do? And he said, we never met with FEMA. He said, they weren't involved in the preparations for evacuation and revising the evacuation plans at all. He said, we did a lot of work with the state of Louisiana. We did a lot of work with Mississippi on helping to get our people out through Mississippi. But FEMA in the last 3 years, even after they identified this as a horrible accident that could happen, never did anything to help the city or state prepare. And in fact, in terms of the delays afterwards, here the emergency preparedness director for the city never heard from FEMA on the weekend before the storm. He never heard from FEMA on Monday after the storm. It wasn't until Tuesday, the day after the storm, that he ever had his first conversation with FEMA.
Now, Mayor Nagin said, I heard him say this to Tim Russert on Sunday, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said that he told evacuees to bring food for a day or two if they were coming to the convention center. And then he expected that after that, the cavalry would come in, you know, the feds would come in and help out and help, you know, do whatever. Was that part of the official New Orleans evacuation plan, that people bring food with them?
Yes, and in fact, they've used the Superdome a couple of times in the past for hurricanes, and that's exactly what they've done. And the hurricane passed, and in a day or two, people went home. I mean, the idea of using the Superdome wasn't such a bad idea. It seems like it, given how horrible it was now. But when you stop and think about it, the storm had winds of 150 to 175 miles an hour as it was approaching. The Louisiana Building Code only requires buildings to be able to withstand 100-mile-an-hour winds. The Superdome is one of the very few buildings in the city built to withstand at least 150-mile-an-hour winds. It's got no windows. It's been up there for 30-something years, and it's never had serious damage in a hurricane. And it's, you know, in the downtown part of the city, which traditionally doesn't flood. So if you look at all those things, I mean, if they would have just put more backup power in it and stocked it with some more food, it would have made a lot of sense. I mean, where they fell down, and they did get food in. I understand the National Guard was bringing in MREs starting on Tuesday as the people's food ran out and people were getting at least a couple of MREs a day there in the Superdome. There was no food brought into the convention center. But I just think if you would have had a way, if there had been more planning that, okay, we've got them in the Superdome. You know, normally they're able to go home after a day or two. But what happens if we get that really bad storm, we get the really big one, and they're stuck in the Superdome and the city's flooded and they can't get out? There should have been that kind of contingency planning, and there should have been more planning for either to mass buses outside the Superdome and in case they had to be evacuated, or there should have been more backup power to keep the, you know, if they could have kept the temperatures at a reasonable degree there, they could have kept a lot of people from dying, and they could have kept violence from flaring out.
At the time of the hurricane, Louisiana had 3,000 National Guard troops that were deployed in Iraq. Had those troops actually been in Louisiana, do you think the situation might have been any different?
My sense is that they could have probably deployed faster, and we've been trying to pin that down because obviously that's probably the most one of the most volatile national political issues here. I think there's only 10, 12,000 National Guard guardsmen in Louisiana, so it was a significant chunk of people. The state still managed to mobilize thousands of guardsmen. It's hard to pin down exactly what equipment. In fact, where the guardsmen normally stage in New Orleans, where their staging ground, they had 20 what they call high-water trucks that are meant to go through flooded areas and help people. And the place they staged those trucks normally doesn't flood. And it ended up with 18 feet of water after some of these levees broke, and they couldn't get these trucks out. So here, on the one hand, we're all worried, legitimately so, about what equipment might have been in Iraq, but some of the equipment they had right here, they couldn't get out because of the unexpected levee breaks.
Chris, one more question. You grew up in New Orleans. Of everything that you've seen since the hurricane, what sticks most in your mind?
Well, I think when I came down from New York right in the aftermath of the hurricane, I really thought I was coming to cover the death of the city, the death of one of the great special American cities like San Francisco or Boston. And I've had such mixed emotions while I've been here because there are vast residential areas of the city out by the lakefront that because of these levee breaks are totally inundated with this awful black, toxic, oily water that's just, you know, sitting there for 2 weeks already, and these houses are going to be filled with mold and they're all going to have to be bulldozed. And, you know, I have two relatives who have houses in those areas. On the other hand, when I go downtown, you know, the French Quarter was hardly damaged. The big office buildings in the CBD just have a lot of broken glass, but not much else. I mean, the skyline has not changed. If you go down St. Charles Avenue and the Garden District and all the mansions that people like to come see, the universities, the hospital, none of that got flooded. All that's in good shape. And Jefferson Parish, the biggest suburb, didn't get hit with flooding and just a lot of wind, power lines down, trees down. But then I was out on a boat yesterday with a city councilwoman, Cynthia Hedge Morrell, and her husband, Arthur, who's a state representative. They were part of the prosperous black middle class that grew up out toward the lakefront in the eastern part side of the city. And we're going past their home. They had 10 to 12 feet of water originally. It's still 5 or 6 feet of water. The stench as you're going through the boat, I mean, we're wearing those, you know, white masks for what help they give, and they're passing all these houses and they're saying, you know, that's Norman Francis's house. He's the president of Dillard, and that's Judge so-and-so's house. And, you know, this whole black middle class, upper middle class, professional class that has risen over the last 20 or 30 years and that now basically runs the city on a political level, the mayor's house not far from there. I mean, all devastated. And I've been peering over the 17th Street levee because one of my relatives lives near there. And it's just the saddest thing to just see this black muck with dogs floating in it and just everything. And in this climate, this humidity, I mean, everything just gets mildewed and mold, and it's just one thing they're going to have to come to grips with is whether they even let people back into some of these areas when they get the water out or whether they just decide to bulldoze them completely.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you talking with us.
No problem. I'm glad to do it.
Thank you very much, and I wish good luck to your family who lives in New Orleans.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Christopher Drew recorded earlier today from New Orleans. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He also co-wrote the bestseller Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage.